Hi, and welcome to this week's edition of the Diplomats Podcast. I'm Ankit Panda from New York.
And I'm Zachary Keck from Washington.
Today we'll be talking about President Obama's upcoming trip to Asia. And after that, we'll be focusing a bit on developments in Northeast Asian diplomacy. U.S. President Barack Obama will travel to Asia next week. He's slated to arrive in Tokyo on April 23rd to begin his four-country tour, following which he will travel to South Korea on April 25th and 26th, where he'll meet with President Park Geun-hye. Following that, President Obama will head over to Southeast Asia, where he's going to be the first American president to visit Malaysia since Lyndon Johnson. And he'll be there from April 26th to 28th, and then he'll be in the Philippines from April 20th to 29th, rounding off his Asia trip. And a lot of people see this trip as pretty much a do-or-die moment for the Asia pivot. A lot of the president's critics and critics of the pivot have said that this is the trip where he'll have to come back with some real deliverables to prove that this is happening. And in addition to his trip to Asia, we have a House delegation from the United States also headed to Asia. Zach, you want to tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, well, the delegation is being led by House Majority Leader Eric Cantor, who's a Republican, and he's leading, I think, a delegation of eight Congress members. Seven of them are Republicans. The eighth is a Democrat, and they're going to be visiting Japan, South Korea, and China. And according to a roll call, they're going to be meeting South Korea's prime minister, Japan's prime minister, Shinzo Abe, and then I haven't seen any reports on who they're exactly going to meet in China besides the U.S. ambassador, Max Baucus. And then they're also going to meet Caroline Kennedy, the U.S. ambassador to Japan, while they're there. So I don't know. This just kind of, I think, is interesting that the trips are overlapping because there's been a pushback in Congress about the pivot. The Senate Foreign Relations Committee just released a report this week pretty much blasting the non-military aspects of the pivot is insufficient. And last month, I believe it was, we saw House members write to Susan Rice. The letter was led by Randy Forbes of Virginia, kind of urging the Obama administration to write a national security strategy for Asia that incorporates a whole government approach. And this is basically what the Senate Foreign Relations Committee report said. At the same time, it's congressional Democrats that are kind of blocking the trade promotional authority that would allow the U.S. to quickly ratify the TPP agreement once negotiations are over.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it'll be interesting to see how these two trips vary. On one side, you have legislators, on one side, you have the president. So let's just talk very quickly about what the president's itinerary and his agenda is in the various countries. So to begin with, he'll be in Japan first. And I believe this is the first time that he's heading to Japan in about 3 years. And obviously, you know, a lot has changed. With Shinzo Abe's rise to power, obviously the regional dynamics have changed entirely. Japan finds itself isolated, not only from its traditional rivals like China, but also from U.S. allies like South Korea. So Obama's discussions with Japan in Japan with Shinzo Abe will focus on broad strategic issues, but also I think a major deliverable. And you know, I think that this is sort of an underappreciated point of the pivot to Asia, which is a Trans-Pacific Partnership. A lot of people read the pivot as primarily a security and defense issue, which is accurate, but also strategic economic ties are absolutely crucial. And I think this will be major obstacle for Obama to overcome when he heads to Japan. I think in the ideal case for the president, he'd want to come back from Japan with some sort of a joint statement with Japan about the TPP because, as I understand it, the U.S. and Japan are slightly at odds on the TPP. Japan has very protectionist policies regarding its agricultural produce and other issues that are vexing at the moment. Additionally, North Korea will clearly be on the agenda in Japan. Japan is pursuing negotiations with North Korea regarding the abducted Japanese citizens issue, which has always been a primary issue for Japanese negotiators in North Korea. And I think the United States will reiterate its views about North Korea, which is that, you know, it's pushing for disarmament, nuclear disarmament in the country, and has requested that North Korea make policy changes in its nuclear program before the six-party talks can ever be resumed. And on that note, I think, you know, that's something that will also carry over to his meetings in South Korea with President Park Geun-hye. In South Korea also, I think it'll be a time for Obama to prove that the United States remains committed to its South Korean ally, particularly as North Korea has been ramping up its provocations and it's been talking about a new type of nuclear test. I think that will be a big part of what the president will be doing in South Korea. And then, Zach, do you want to tell us a bit about what he'll be addressing when he heads to the Philippines and Malaysia?
Yeah, real quick, if I could just add, there's actually interesting the trip that the South Korea, Japan, and U.S. Diplomats to the six-party negotiations with North Korea actually kind of lowered the bar this week, earlier this week, or maybe it was last week. They met in Washington, and they changed the language that they've been using with North Korea to basically suggest that as long as North Korea recommits to the principles contained in the Leap Day deal from back in 2010, was it, or 2011?
2010, yeah, I think so, yeah.
They said that they basically said that they would restart talks. So that was interesting that that happened right before this trip. But yeah, after South Korea, Obama's going to be heading to Malaysia. He'll be the first sitting U.S. president to visit Malaysia in 50 years. Malaysia's state media has really said that the issues they're going to talk about are mainly going to be economic, particularly the Trans-Pacific Partnership. The focus there will probably be mostly on economics. This is really highlighting what you were talking about, Ankit, as far as the TPP being a huge part of the Asia pivot. There's also suggestions they're going to talk about strengthening defense ties. Some Obama advisors reportedly want Malaysia to be sort of a strategic partner in the same vein as Thailand, which is a U.S. ally, and Singapore. We might see some defense stuff in Malaysia. Mainly defense stuff is going to be, I think, in the Philippines, where the U.S. and the Philippines are expected to sign a new military hosting agreement, which we've talked about before on this podcast and written many articles about. So basically give U.S. military greater access to different bases in the Philippines, which will allow it to increase its presence in the South China Sea. And this is really coming, obviously, in response to China taking control of the Scarborough Shoal, and it looks like it's trying to take control over the Second Thomas Shoal. And actually, I was just reading a report yesterday that when China was blockading the Filipino Marines on the Second Thomas Shoal, and as reporters on board Filipino vessels were trying to resupply those Marines, a U.S. surveillance plane was flying low altitude, so it could be pictured by the journalist as they were trying to get around these Chinese vessels. So that was interesting.
Yeah, absolutely.
We'll probably see more of that now.
Yeah, I mean, I think the Philippines trip is going to be a big deliverable for the pivot. Coming back with that sort of base access agreement is going to placate some critics, I think, that think the United States is, you know, essentially not committing its resources in a way befitting the new security challenges in the region. So I think that'll be very important. And it's, you know, it's a guarantee that he's going to come back from the Philippines with that. Some of the other questions about the TPP negotiations are still very indeterminate. We don't really know what's going to happen in Japan and Malaysia with regard to those discussions. But the Philippines is pretty much a guarantee, which is good for the Obama administration and for the pivot.
Well, I think the trip as far as the TPP goes, one, it would be nice. I think he's going to maybe try to get South Korea. There's been some indication South Korea will join the negotiations, which would be obviously huge. I doubt they're going to announce that South Korea is joining it this week, but I'm sure that'll be brought up and the U.S. will urge South Korea to join. But I think the big part is there's a lot of doubt in Asia right now that Obama can get the TPP ratified, or that he's interested in devoting to the political capital gets the TPP ratified in Congress, because as I mentioned, there's been a lot of congressional Democrats that are sort of opposing it. So I think what you're going to see is Obama come out strongly in favor of it and sort of rededicate himself to the issue of getting the TPP ratified, and mainly to show the regional states in Asia that it's committed to the pact, and also to signal the congressional Democrats to be ready to get in line after the election's over.
Right, absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, a lot of people have been talking about how President Obama hasn't really had access to Asia. I mean, he had to cancel his trip last fall. But, you know, just recently, he met with President Park and President Abe in a trilateral setting at the Nuclear Security Summit. And you know, they made some good progress on some issues. There was the first time that Shinzo Abe and Park and Hay were in a room together, a meeting privately. So that was a big development then, too. So I think, you know, it's really not as much as a start from scratch as some people think it is. I think there are, you know, clear diplomatic threads that are going to be picked up when he heads to Asia next week.
Yeah, I think the whole pivot, I think, has been kind of misportrayed. I think the real goal is to signal a sort of a the U.S. Senate was going to be in it for the long term rather than a sudden shift to Asia. So I think, like, you see this in the defense budget where the U.S. is sacrificing near-term readiness for stronger capabilities in, like, starting in 2020, you know, the next decade, yeah. when it sees China's military power potentially growing to the point where it might mount challenges. And you see this with the TPP, which is sort of a longer-term thing. So I think in some ways this whole notion this is a do-or-die trip for the Asia pivot is just so overblown. I just think that the balance of power, the global power, is shifting so much to Asia that the U.S. is going to basically have to, you know, rebalance towards Asia regardless of who's in office and their commitment. So I think those reports that are saying it's do or die for the Asia pivot, this trip, I think are wrong. We should also mention also that Obama is going to be in Asia later in the next fall, in the upcoming fall.
He's in November.
Yeah, he'll be in China, in Burma, and one other country, I can't remember which. Australia, I think. So I don't think it's a do or die trip. It'll be interesting to see, but I think usually there's not too many surprises on these trips. I would think there'd be more deliverables than are being reported right now, but we'll see.
Yeah, I mean, you know, just to add to that, I think it's a case of people kind of losing track of the grand strategic implications of the pivot and kind of getting distracted by things like Syria and Ukraine and the Israeli-Palestinian peace process, which a lot of people have criticized the State Department of putting most of its diplomatic resources towards those crises and less towards Asia. But I think that the long-term focus on Asia is still persisting.
Yeah, and I think they're completely right. I think the John Kerry, as far as he's been taking like 13 trips, I think, to Israel and Palestine. That's ridiculous.
Yeah, that's kind of his pet project.
Yeah, and it just doesn't make any sense, even in terms of the Middle East, but especially in terms of U.S. global interests. But I think the news media and pundits and stuff, they see like they want immediate. If there's not immediate things going on that they can report on, they assume nothing's happening.
Yeah.
And I don't think that's necessarily true. Although I do think that people in Asia are concerned about this, so that's a problem. I think that would be Obama's goal will be to counteract that narrative, at least in Asia.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, speaking of long-term changes, I guess this is a nice segue into our next discussion here on the podcast, which is there are some signs that relations between Japan and South Korea and relations between China and Japan actually are starting to, if not entirely warm up, slightly take a step back from the deep freeze they've been heading towards. There are signs that Japan and China are heading towards a detente, and South Korea and Japan are also making some good diplomatic progress. So, Zach, do you want to start off by telling us a bit about the developments between Japan and China?
Yeah, well, basically, I wrote a piece earlier this week outlining them. There's been a lot of sort of track two diplomacy going on, or in one case, city-to-city diplomacy. A former general secretary of the Communist Party, Sun, was in Japan last week or earlier this month and met with Japan's foreign minister, chief cabinet secretary, and actually Prime Minister Shinzo Abe, it's been reported, and then a former Japan Prime Minister was in China for an economic forum. And then the new Tokyo governor is going to be going to Beijing next week. And then also the chief of staff of Japan's Maritime Self-Defense Forces is supposed to meet with the People's Liberation Army Navy's chief of staff in China later this month. Well, that might be off now because China canceled the Pacific Fleet Review. So I'm not sure if the symposium where they're supposed to meet is going on. But this... And there's also M. Taylor Fravel and Alistair Johnston at Harvard published an analysis showing that Chinese patrols of the 12-mile zone around the Diaoyu Senkaku Islands has drastically dropped off since October. So I don't really think that this is they're gonna settle anything definitively, but I think this is showing a real fear potentially of miscalculations. At first, it didn't really seem like China really cared about miscalculations.
Right.
But I think Japan really pushed back on them by saying it would shoot down a drone, for instance. And I think this kind of raised concerns on both sides. They were heading towards disaster, possibly with the U.S. behind the scenes moderating. And so I think they're really trying to pull back from the brink now, which is a good thing. But I'm not sure it solves anything long term, but it definitely reduces tensions in the short term.
Yeah, God knows Japan's decision to put troops on Yonaguni Island, its its westernmost inhabited island is going to destabilize things slightly. China's already reacted angrily to that. So we'll see where things go. But I'm not very optimistic for an immediate change, obviously, with regards to the final status of the Senkaku Diaoyu dispute. Regarding South Korea and Japan, they've actually set up a diplomatic channel to address the comfort women issue. And this isn't track two. This is track one officials meeting. And this is quite a development considering that high-level diplomacy between South Korea and Japan had pretty much been at a standstill for almost the entire year that a little more than a year that Shinzo Abe has been in office. It comes on the heels of a lot of controversy, particularly facing, you know, Shinzo Abe's visit to Yasukuni Shrine, the later internal debate in the Liberal Democratic Party in Japan about revising the Kono Declaration, which was a declaration in 1993 apologizing for Japan's Imperial Army's transgressions in Korea during the war, including the use of comfort women. So this, I think, is a slightly more encouraging diplomatic development, because it shows that these two important U.S. allies are coming together to kind of address this historical issue. And I should note that this is the first time that Japan and South Korea will formally address the comfort women issue in a diplomatic setting. I don't know, Zach, what do you think? Do you think this will lead to a slight warming of ties between Japan and Korea?
It could. I mean, I think this whole revising the 93 statement was largely brought up by like conservatives in Japan, not even within the LDP, I believe, but sort of way more conservatives than Shinzo Abe and the chief cabinet secretary, like, should have shot it down, but he didn't. He sort of said, like, fine, we'll, like, look into this, which was a mistake.
Yeah.
This is kind of Japan reversing itself. But what I want to see ultimately, and this is what annoys me, and why I can kind of sympathize with Japan, even though I think it's done its fair share to increase tensions with both South Korea and China, is that South Korea and China are always saying Japan needs to recognize its history, Japan needs to do this, and they say very vague generalities. They need to sit there and say, this is what we want you to do to put history behind us. Like, very concrete actions. Like, we want you to pay this amount of money to former comfort women or for war reparations. And they never do that. And I think that kind of discourages Japan from taking steps, because they look at it like the 93 statement on comfort women seems pretty clear that it's like, you know, the Japanese army, like, set up these comfort women. This wasn't like an ad hoc thing. And so, you know, I mean, they said it very clearly in a diplomatic statement. And so I don't know if they're going to get through this issue until like Japan has a clear indication, which I think should be public, from South Korea and potentially China about what Japan can do to put history behind it, so they can all move on and look towards the future. So I don't know. I think there's limited.
Yeah. I mean, I think so the way I understand it is that publicly so far, South Korea has said that the Japanese government should apologize to the victims and offer compensation. They haven't said exactly what kind of compensation. And I believe a quotation from the government is that the dispute should be resolved effectively and in a way that is agreeable to the living victims. Again, very indeterminate. But I think that that's precisely the purpose of these talks right now. It'll allow probably not a public declaration, but a private sort of negotiation for, you know, what the Abe government will be willing to do politically and what South Korea would like it to do. And hopefully they can arrive at some sort of understanding there.
But what is that? I mean, like, Germany is always held up by China and South Korea as like the example for contrition or whatever. Like, Germany didn't apologize to every former, you know, individually to every former Holocaust survivor. I mean, how many comfort women are there that Japan has to, and how does Japan apologize personally to them? I think another thing is that, like, Japan has this, like, there's people in Japan that some of them are, like, you know, low level politicians that occasionally make these statements that are awful, completely offensive and stuff. But how is, I'm just not sure, like, Japan being a democracy, it's going to be able to continue to stop those. I mean, these are very minority already, so I don't know how Japan's going to be able to make sure that no one in Japan says any statement that's offensive to China and South Korea. And what China and South Korea could really do is ignore them, but they seem to play up these statements now. I mean, I think China's doing it for a very clear reason,
yeah,
which is to distract people from it. It's attempts to change the status quo, but I think South Korea, I don't know exactly.
Yeah, I mean, the more insidious problem in Northeast Asia is a public opinion, really. And you look at You know, despite any diplomatic progress being made, public opinion is still awful towards Japan and South Korea and China. I mean, there was that one survey that we covered a few months ago that rated Kim Jong-un more favorably than Shinzo Abe. There's really, you know, deep-seated hatred there. And I think that's, you know, owing to what you said, is that Japan can't really control the fact that it does have a very prominent, loud right-wing contingent that will continue to say things that will upset South Korea and China.
Yeah, but I also think, and maybe I could be wrong, but I think, I mean, this public opinion thing is somewhat controlled by the elites in South Korea and China. I mean, if the leaders of South Korea and China play up every time someone makes a stupid comment, like, people are going to get mad. But if they don't, like, you know, acknowledge it or whatever, I just think that there's going to be less animosity, really.
Yeah, also as to the media. Well, more in South Korea than in China. Well, equally in China, actually. Xinhua and Global Times don't help things either with their inflammatory editorials about Japan. But
yeah, but that's, again, state media. That's China's leaders playing it up.
Right. I guess it'll be a bit of a wait and see game. I mean, this is going to be a crucial time right now. A lot of diplomatic developments going on in the region.
Yeah, and I think one thing that might help actually is this new nuclear test. As far as Japan and South Korea, I mean, I don't want this new nuclear test to happen from North Korea, but generally I think North Korea's belligerence pushes South Korea and Japan together.
Yeah, it does. It's definitely a case of, you know, security concerns trumping everything else, trumping history and beliefs. And
yeah, and that might be why actually Japan said it was going to shoot down, or didn't publicly announce, but apparently it was reported that it's put out an order to shoot down North Korea missiles. And I think that might have been actually directed just as much at South Korea as it was at to protect Japan.
Yeah. Well, I think that about covers it for this week's podcast. Thanks a lot for listening.
Thank you.
We'll be back next week. Yeah.